Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the annual wrap-up equity overview. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm joined by Tim Caban, who is a financial planner in Malvern, Pennsylvania. His firm is Copper Beach Advisors, and he is a very rare and unique person, very desirable person in this environment because he's a financial planner who can integrate across all balance sheets and talk about the real deal. So Tim, it's always a pleasure. And it was when I was down in Pennsylvania in the fall, I got a chance to see you. You look great. Business is good. So thank you for joining us on the Salary Report. And thank you again for everything you're doing. You're helping a lot of people.
Well, thank you, Catherine, and it's terrific to be back again. Thank you for having me back, and great seeing you in Malvern. So I look forward to the discussion.
So again, and I repeat every time I've introduced him, he had a very successful career on Wall Street and then moved to becoming a financial planner really because he wanted to improve his family's personal way of life. And so as a result, you can go all the way from the derivatives market to building local community to healthcare to anything a family faces, because that's what you and your family face. But you can do it in the context of understanding Wall Street and where it fits in.
Absolutely. And I think when we made this move for our family years ago, I just kind of had an intuitive understanding that hyper local was a good way to be resilient, notwithstanding all the challenges we face today, just in the world we were living in, and moving out of a high cost area to a low cost area, and for schools, for children, and all kinds of different factors that weighed into that.
Well, I told you somebody was complaining that they'd been to the store and organic eggs were $10 a dozen. And I said, oh, Tim is doing well.
Yes,
Because you have chickens, right?
I do. We have chickens, and I have the benefit. One interesting thing: we had a sick chicken, and the whole avian flu virus, and culling hundreds of thousands of chickens. And I was able to give our chicken homeopathy and bring it back from the dead, which was nice. It was surprising. But then we also had the misfortune to recently lose a chicken to a red-tailed hawk. So we've experienced both sides of the things.
It's livestock is never easy, is my experience.
Yes.
But it's getting more economic. That is just,
It is for sure
it
if you go
is.
check out the grocery store.
Okay, so let's start. I just want to start by reminding everybody that I'm going to do a screen share and just show we have a web presentation for every wrap up. And if you just go to any of the annual wrap ups, you can link, you'll see it in the top, you'll be able to link to the web presentation. And our theme this year is pharma food. It's a report that we'll publish on January 31st, the same day Tim and I are recording. And it's on synthetic food with a focus on lab-grown meat. And if you haven't been inspired to establish a local fresh food supply, this will do it. It's the only way. I can't wait for you to read this, Tim, because it's really a blockbuster. And if you look at the amount of money that's being thrown at this, at synthetic food, I think it will shock even you. It's
Yeah, and you may know I'm a food fanatic, and I love cooking and growing my own food and networking and having, so I'll definitely be interested in this.
So we're going to put up, there's a section called Who's Your Farmer, where we just wrote a piece on local, Pete Kennedy wrote a piece on how to, what local food legislation is needed in all these different areas to make sure you have a local fresh food system. And then, of course, we'll put up his piece on local food resources as well. So there's plenty of things to get you going on local fresh food, but that will be your response to this report. I'm just going to skim through it. It's a pretty significant report. Elsa spent months doing it, and I'll just skim down it. You can
I would
see.
just say that I think when you get out there in the community and start to network, that there really are local food networks almost anywhere. They take different forms. If you're in the city, it might be a farmer's market. You might have to drive. Farmers are driving into the city to sell their wares. If you kind of meet them halfway, there's all kinds of options to do for local food.
Absolutely. I think it's a matter of finding people you can trust, and just, it's a process like anything, it's a journey.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm We'll go into it when, so Elsa and I publish a big interview on this on tonight.
Okay.
But this is a major report. And what's so shocking is when you see the amount of money that's being poured into something that can never work, and can never be economic. So this is not, this is very strategic investment. It's not investment that's attracted by the possibility of returns, which is kind of frightening to me.
One of the things that you, as you're scrolling through there, that comes to mind is all the laws around food. And if you deal with anybody here in Pennsylvania, I'm close to the Amish in Lancaster, that you don't need all those laws to have wholesome food. And it just is an indication of the motivations, I think.
Right, because they're if you're going to change or evolve or control the currency, you need to control certain asset classes. And to me, food is the big one.
Yeah.
So let me just jump and quick show the financial market section on the web presentation is here. And it shows we have the Rambus Chartology, which is a big report on both precious metals and commodities. Precious metals being Rambus's really sort of core area. And then charts for the year for fixed income commodities and equities. I'm not going to go through them. But needless to say, last year was a year where we finally, you know, for many years, I've been waiting for the big correction. And to say, you know, the correction, the major correction was long overdue, but that doesn't still, you know, even when it's long overdue, Tim, we're big babies when it comes.
We are. And I mean, if you look at the correction, and everybody's whipped up about the correction and the news articles, but relative to where we were in 2021, we're not that bad off at this point. And in 2021, nobody was concerned about being at that level. So it's interesting on the way up and the way down, the different perspectives.
Right, right. So to me, one of the most surprising things of last year was the underperformance of the 60-40 portfolio relative to historical. And if you, I just looked at a chart somebody did that showed it was the worst 60-40 performance ever. So
just
talk
barely,
a little bit.
Almost, just barely.
Yeah, just barely, but it was still worse. So explain the 60-40 portfolio and talk about why this is such an important point.
Well, the 60-40 portfolio, that means 60% stocks and 40% bonds. And if you just stop there, it belies the details that matter, especially in the bond section, the 40% bond. And like you said, it's not the only time in history that bonds have gone down at the same time as stocks. The other biggest time, I think, if I was looking at that chart, was in the mid 70s, leading up to the 80s, Paul Volcker raising the rates up to 20% on short-term Fed funds. But the thing to understand is that bond prices move in the opposite direction of interest rates. And so we were in a situation last year where you had stocks going down. I think people have been through that before and they understand it, but we've been through 10 years of very low interest rates and 40 years, as you've observed many times, of a general decline in the level of interest rates, broadly speaking. And so I think it was easy to forget what can happen when interest rates go up to bond prices. And that's a problem because the traditional advice to people is to have 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds. And then when stocks go down, take your bonds, which have saved you, which have stayed steady, and then buy stocks when they're cheaper. And you have this long-term disciplined way to approach stocks and bonds. But the shock last year was that bonds went down significantly.
Right.
Together with stocks.
Right. And so, you know, depending on which bonds and what maturity, because it's the big problem's on the long end. So the longer the maturity, the more the bond will go down to a given, you know, rise in interest rates. And so I think so many people had been trained to believe my bonds will protect me. And then when they don't, it increases the general anxiety and not understanding what's going on and why.
I think that some of the things like target date funds or the 60-40 portfolio that's offered by Vanguard kind of encourage people not to understand. They figure, oh, well, Vanguard will just take care of it. But Vanguard, the 40% of the bond portfolio is in a mid intermediate term bond. that goes down a lot more than a short-term bond if interest rates go up, and they leave it that way. Now they you can read articles about why they think that makes sense, but I think that was somewhat of a surprise to me.
Well, but you pointed out in one of the emails you sent me, if you'd been in 5-year bonds, you know, the 60-40 portfolio would have worked.
It would have worked?
Or it would have worked better.
The shorter the maturity, the better, or the less you lose. So right. The 5-year bond is, you know, for every, there's a rule in investments that if you have a 5-year bond, if interest rates go up by 1%, that fund will lose 5%. And that's called a duration. It's a rule that you can use as a rule of thumb. But if you have a 1-year bond and interest rates go up by 1%, the value will go down by 1% because it's a 1-year bond. So it's all relative. 5-year bond works better than the Vanguard Total Bond Fund, which is almost seven years. But 1-year bond works better than 5-year bond, just so on the scale of things.
I don't know if you saw this. It was kind of funny. It was a big shocker. I forget when it was. It was quite a while ago when the Swiss central bank started to buy U.S. stocks and took this huge position in stocks. So the other day, the head of the Swiss bank was being criticized for the fact that they had taken such a big loss this year on their stock portfolio. And he pointed out that if they'd stayed in the bonds they were normally in, it would have been worse.
Yeah.
But to see a central banker say that.
That's shocking.
It's shocking. That's shocking. We're better off in equities. So one of the things I really noticed, because oftentimes I would have clients come to me and say, I want to do an annuity. I would say, don't be ridiculous, because you're going to get tied up in a long-term credit that might change and you don't control. And I said, just go get a custom portfolio of really, you know, the appropriate bonds built and do your own and create your own annuity. And then you have control. And if you want to cancel it, you can. So, but what I found in building custom portfolios of bonds is that you had to be unbelievably careful about credit, and not just credit today, but credit, you know, is this company a buggy whip company, or is it a company that's going to be here in 20 years? And, I sent you that poll from of Pricewaterhouse did on the CEOs, where you could see they were clearly worried about whether they'd be around in 10 years.
Yeah.
So what I've noticed in this environment in both stocks and any securities is that you can't just buy the market. You really have to understand, you know, exactly what you're buying. And, you know, for my portfolio, what I'm looking at are the individual stocks or bonds. Mm-hmm. So I told you, if I won the lottery today, I would definitely do bonds, because now bonds are attractive, right? Yeah. Now you can come in and it's 5%. But on credit, I'm very, very nervous. And so the idea of just buying a basket of bonds for me is just, I would never do it.
Makes sense. I understand why you would do that. And also there's a benefit, because you're hyper-focused on the credit aspect and understanding. If we understand that a bond is a loan, you care. If you're loaning money to somebody, how creditworthy are they? And are you going to get your money back? But the extra benefit of doing a custom portfolio of bonds is that you can choose to hold that bond to maturity, which is another issue for people. If you're holding a bond fund, a mutual fund, that never matures. So you don't have that extra option to hold it to maturity and avoid losing money. Because if you hold a bond to maturity, it doesn't matter what rates do, you'll get your money back.
Right. So for me, it's not just credit, but it's the yield on that credit. Because there's absolutely a place you can buy where you're willing to take some default risk because the interest more than, you know, that's sort of the junk bond play. And that can work. But you really, in this environment, you just really have to know your credits.
Yeah, and I'm not quick to get into junk bonds just because of what you said. To me, the rate, the yield on the bond indicates the risk. So the reason it's called junk bond, they call it high yield so they can sell the bonds. But it's proverbially called junk bonds because the credit quality is lower. And yeah, it can work out. but it could also not work out. And so
so I'll tell you what the hardest thing was for me this year was, because I do the mm-hmm. screen, I went through and we re-underwrote every company on the whole screen, which was a huge mm-hmm. job. And what you see is the pandemic literally destroyed great companies. It literally, here's a company that spent decades building, you know, something that was world-class in its field. One of the companies I most admire in the world was Qantas. Mm-hmm. And Qantas, you know, I had to throw Qantas off and I couldn't believe it. And there's something about watching a great company die that's really, it's almost like watching a person yeah. die. It's painful.
To me, the example of that is GE. For many years, GE was held in every grandmother's portfolio, and the CEO, there's right. a certain CEO that ran it into the ground, basically, over a period of years. And it's kind of sad to watch, because you see, growing up, all the years of watching Jack Welch and GE as a respected company, and then it really took a dive.
So I don't, have you ever read Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit?
No, I haven't read that.
Oh, you would love that book too. But he has a story about Paul O'Neill at Alcoa, which is one of my favorite business stories in okay. the world. And Paul O'Neill, we're gonna do a series of wrap-ups on governance, so I'll get into it in more detail. But Paul O'Neill came into Alcoa and it was in trouble. He had come in from government, he had been at OMB, and he decided, he did a big survey of what the company's problems was, and he announced to the board that their number one goal was worker safety. And the board was apoplectic. It's like, get this guy out of here. He'll never make a profit, you know, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, and the story deserves a lot more detail, the workers really got galvanized, felt safe again, you know, fixed worker safety. Then they went to work on company profitability, and the company skyrocketed fabulously. And the board was in shock. And it's what a partner of mine used to call the gestalt thing. In other words, you know, what makes a company as a living system really go? And some of the ingredients are just, they're gestalt things. They're not something you can explain from a business school textbook of profitability anyway. But we would look at these boards and we'd say, you know, these guys just don't get they have a Paul O'Neill yeah. problem. You know, they're trying to, you know, it's 20 years of cutting corners, and now with the pandemic, there are no more corners to cut and they're in trouble.
And that gives them the why. Anyway. I think the other quick why with historical one is Hyundai, because they were trying to break into the auto market. I believe they led with their warranty and said, we're going to have a 10-year warranty, and either we're going to be successful or we're going to be out of business. But it gave the focus right. for everybody working towards the same direction to make quality cars so they could live up to the warranty.
I forgot that story. You're right. That's a great, I got to write that one down. I bring that up because, the pandemic basically was a company killer for many, you know, I wouldn't say a huge number, but it did some real damage. But the other thing we saw do real damage was literally a tear in the fabric in the markets because of the Russian sanctions, and then because of sort of China and Hong Kong pulling away. And so you literally, if you're a Western investor, you saw your Russian stocks go to zero in perfectly good companies. And then your valuations on the Chinese stocks were affected, or you have to get out because you feel nervous about where this is going. So we're literally watching it's almost like it's not a liquidity event, but it certainly was for mm-hmm. Russia. But real questions about the long-term liquidity of big pieces of the market.
Yeah, and the other aspect when you come into that kind of a discussion is the dollar and the currency differentials there, because, you know, without right. the dollar, for example, if they do CBDC and there's no currency differential between currencies in their ideal view, then that enables better control and it gets rid of being subject to the implications of different currencies going against each other.
So I'll tell you so I have many fears about CBDC, but if you look at the equity markets or the corporate securities markets, my concern is that the US has kept what I call a negative return on investment economy going by pumping out massive amounts of subsidies into certain sectors and playing games with taking up government debt to inject those subsidies. Now that the debt growth model is over and they can't do that to inject the subsidies, you go to complete control where you can keep the negative return economy going by simply freezing people's accounts, delivering negative interest rates or taxation without representation. And to me, the last thing you need is total control to keep negative returns going. Why not reverse the positive returns?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Why not just change the model? You know, but the people who succeeded on the negative return don't want to change the model. And if you look at the wealth destruction that could occur, it's phenomenal. I mean, to me, CBDCs is a wealth destroyer. That's what it is.
And to me, that's part of the reason why big companies, because when you talk about anymore, it's not a U.S. company or a German company, because these big global conglomerates have operations everywhere. And those companies are more likely, if they have no moral core or no guiding gestalt, then they're looking at it from a dollar perspective, and then they're more likely to go on board with all the nonsense about the CBDC and stuff like that, I think.
So I just saw the New Economist rolled in with a cover that says Goldman Sachs, S-A-G-S. So, you know, it's a hit piece on Goldman. I haven't read it yet. But one of the things I know is they got in real trouble on their loan business. And, you know, you kind of want to say to them, look, that's what happens when you bankrupt your customers. You know, when you liquidate your customers, maybe your retail loan business won't go so well.
I thought, and I'm going to not remember exactly, but reading the Whitney Webb book about the history of Goldman and the fact that they named their online lending platform Marcus. And there's a relationship. I can't remember right now, but if you read her book, you can tie in that Marcus name to the past. It's an interesting analogy.
Well, it's funny because tradition, you know, I was a summer intern at Goldman Sachs, and I decided instead to go to Dillon Reed instead of Goldman, because Goldman, you had to specialize quickly. But, you know, at that point, the name was, you know, the equivalent of outstanding and excellence. And I've seen that name go sort of into the sewer. And I was very surprised when they went out to do a retail product that they didn't know their name was in the sewer. I thought that was
they were subject to the same hot money of all these different online banks that try to raise money by jacking up the rate and then cutting it and do it. They were just another player. Right. They weren't distinguished in any way for their name.
Right. Well, I don't know. You know, in Hickory Valley, their name's not so good. Okay, so let's turn to 2023, and I just want to go back to the website for a second. And I've got the this chart you showed on the 5-year constant maturity. Did you want to comment on that? I thought that was a great chart.
Yeah,
from
I think
Fred.
if you pull the bottom of that chart, there's a slider, and if you pull that all the way to the left, it will give you. So there's like a little go to the right on that bottom chart. Right there. Slide that all the way to the left. And then that gives you, this tells us the kind of the history of rates. And you can see in the 1980s when rates went up and when we went off the gold standard and all that. So if you look at all the way to the right, most recently what we had, and bonds lost money when bonds lose money when interest rates go up. They went up, but relative to what's happened in the past, it's nothing.
It was nothing.
Now, it doesn't mean the past is going to necessarily happen again. The Fed says they're going to slow down raising rates. Who knows? But it's possible, or the potential is there for things to get worse, potentially.
So here's the thing to understand, because I remember being on Wall Street because the long bond, the long New York municipal tax exempt bond was 18% at this peak. I'll never forget it. From here down to where we are today, you've had governments all around the world loading up massive amounts of debt at low interest rates.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take getting back to here to bankrupt. That's the dollar bear trap I'm always talking about. Anyway, so let's turn to 2023. Every year in the annual wrap up, we do scenario designs. And this year, our scenarios are, there are two variables and then four, you know, the two axes produce four scenarios. One axis is what I call the great poisoning, and that includes the rise in all-cause mortality. Lots of debate about whether it's the injections or other things, but we're watching a very significant rise, particularly in the United States, of all-cause mortality. Dr. Skidmore was just listening to an interview of Ed Dowd, who said that 7,500 extra people are leaving the workforce every day, 2,500 from death and 5,000 from disability. And we know disability as of, you know, last year was up 3 million from a couple, 2 years before in the US. So, so one of the variables is just the great poisoning, you know, do we bring it to an end or get it low, or does it continue at a high rate, even accelerating? Then the other is, are we able to push back against the incursion on individual and national sovereignty? So we can return sovereignty to sort of a high place or not, it's low. So, you know, low is where CBDCs happen, et cetera.
I think it's a great simple way to just know, to understand the world in one context, but then it gives us our marching orders. What do we need to work on and what do we need to defend against?
Right, so if you're a family and you wanna be financially secure, you gotta protect yourself and your family against the great poisoning. You have to, you know, if you don't have your health, you got nothing. And it's very expensive to lose your health in this environment, as you know. But then the other is, you know, and I think this is one of the reasons we're seeing massive movement of people, you know, from jurisdictions that have low sovereignty to jurisdictions that have higher sovereignty.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, so
one quick thing about this, I saw in that PwC survey, it said job one is scenario planning for a wider range of disruption. So that it's interesting, with all the years I've listened to you about scenario planning, that they wrote that in that PwC survey.
So, you know, something, I'm a great believer in scenario planning. I got introduced to it in the early 90s. And it, you know, it really does a remarkable job of helping you think through all, particularly the worst case scenarios, you know, the ones you don't want to think about, the ones you don't want to deal with. Oh, please, God, let that not happen. But by putting it out on the table and figuring out what would we do? You know, there's opportunity in everything. And as a team of people, if you can be tracking the variables that are driving events and then be prepared for, you know, it going this way versus that way. And one of the reasons I love it, Tim, is I think the worst thing that can happen is you bet the ranch on a particular view of the future. And it's funny, because I'm always, when I was an investment advisor, I always fought with clients who would get a hold of a particular website that had prophecies about the future. And they would want to bet their entire portfolio on that vision of the future. And I was like, no, because the prophecies never come true. Do you know what I mean? Or they don't come with the timing you want.
Yeah. My absolute favorite Solari report is the interview you did with Eric Best. I read his book about where he sailed around the world. But it's he has a unique way of communicating this concept. It just is very smooth the way he communicates it. And, but in practice, you give us these tools. It's great to be able to pay attention.
Yeah, well, you know, taking a course with someone like Eric. So I trained with Eric to do scenario planning. And it was, I don't know, you know, anyway, so he's, if I had a company, I'd go hire him. we are endeavoring to get to the point where we can afford to hire Eric to come in. Okay, so let me talk about some of the big risk issues. Interest rates have moderated a little bit. We have the Fed meeting today, so they're expected to bump either 25 to 50 basis points. You know, to me, interest rates are both an opportunity and a risk. So, you know, if you've got big variable rate debt, they're a risk. But frankly, if you haven't been able to buy a 5% high quality bond before now, that's an opportunity.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
The only question, I mean, you got to look forward and say, you know, what's happened. It's just, you can buy a 5% bond now, but if your bond was already decimated, you're going to have to take a couple of 5% bonds to get back to where you were before.
Right. The other thing is, if you're looking to sell or buy housing, you know, interest
Liquidity.
rates have had a big impact on the housing market and will probably have continue to have a big one this coming year. So.
Interesting when you think that outside of the US, not everybody has a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. They're much shorter, they're variable, even in Canada. So people are in different countries, even or different situations, will be confronted with higher rates sooner than later.
Right. So the big one is inflation. And what's interesting is if you look at the corporate surveys or the individual surveys or the small business surveys or the farmer, everyone across the board, inflation is number one concern. And I know you have lots of clients who are managing households and they're getting squeezed. So how are you helping people deal with inflation?
We're trying, you know, one aspect is what you all talk about with keeping costs low if you can, and then trying to earn a yield on fixed income without losing money to just slow the rate of burn to kind of last through it. And then to not sell stocks in a, because they're down, because they're the longest term engine of growth for the longer term. And so trying to balance all these things with all the concerns that people have and understanding there's no perfect solution. There's no magic investment that will guarantee you success against all inflation, where, like you said, the promise, where you just stick all your assets in there and then you can relax because it takes care of it, because it's a balance of the different things.
So you know, here's my, it's kind of a conundrum as to what to tell people. Because all last year as the market was dropping, I was looking at the companies I love and I'm like, sales. You know, I felt like you know, when I used to live in New York and Saks would have a big sale, it was like sales. So for me, it was an opportunity. But if I had been sitting in a big broad-based ETF full of what I consider to be total crap, you know, I would have been, you know, you feel like the world is falling out from under and you don't trust. I mean, there's nothing real to keep it up. So if you look at the seven, I mean, the thing that was really down was the seven stinkers. You know, the big momentum stocks and stocks, you know, for the most part are companies I don't want anything to do with. If you weren't in them, you know, things looked a lot better.
They did, but it
So,
didn't go up quite as much on the way up. It makes me think of the 99 2000 tech bubble, where growth stocks, and you, I think now we're moving into value stocks doing a little bit better, and those are lower priced stocks, generally speaking, because they're closer to the book value or the balance sheet than a growth stock. But that, I always think about the last time that happened, when the big tech stocks blew off steam and outperformed everything else. And then what followed was the tech bubble burst. So we'll see what happens. But
Well, but I, you know, I for one welcome return to value because if you look at the tech stocks that had momentum, they're the guys who are bringing in transhumanism and technocracy.
yeah, they
You
are.
know, so get them out of my life. You know, the value companies are, I think for most people, much easier to understand. Now, you know, I think the problem for a busy person who doesn't want to manage their own money is, you know, they tend to go into products which are a broad index, and that's what makes me feel uncomfortable because I don't, you know, at this point I don't have a lot of faith in any systems.
There are solutions out there if you want to kind of implement what you're talking about. It's just they're not as widely available and as well known as the index funds, but they are out there.
Yeah, but it takes, you have to expend work on, you know, I go back to Peter Lynch. You have to know what you own and why you own it. And I think this is an environment where if you know what you own and why you own it, and how, you know, the number one mistake I find people make is not insisting on understanding what they're doing. So I'll tell you, I was, Lucy Commissar has a new investigative report on insurance companies that are deteriorating in credit. You know, the private equity firms are buying them, and then the next thing you know, they're juicing money out, doing a variety of games, and the credit's going down. And somebody who holds an annuity in that company doesn't realize, you know, that there's something they should be paying attention to. Anyway, so I'm reading this, and I go on one of the websites. So this is a company that got bought by a famous private equity firm about a year and a half ago, And Tim, I watched 3 minutes of videos and then read descriptions for another 5 minutes. I could not understand a word of what they said. I had no idea what they're doing. It was all complete bubble, pretzel, talk, conceptual. It was like, what are they talking about? Absolutely no sense. And when it was over, I felt totally incoherent. I was just like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that individual people should have the confidence in themselves that if they don't understand something, they shouldn't do it. They should be able to understand things.
Right. Right. But how do you help people understand they have the right to insist on understanding?
That's a good question. I just tell them, but then I tell them that nothing I ever say is because I'm an expert. Everything I say should have a reason, and then you can evaluate it and we can talk about it. But to encourage that kind of a dialogue, and not everybody has the capacity to understand at a high level, but you should be able to understand at a basic level about what you're doing and why it either does or doesn't make sense to you. And if somebody can't explain that to you, then, you know, if you're working with an advisor, you should find somebody who can, I think.
Right. But it's a process. It takes time. Okay. Food and health, big area. Food and health, because, you know, you and I both know, anybody listening to this knows, you can be fantastically successful financially. You can build a great company, sell it for a fortune. And then a couple of healthcare frauds can totally destroy you and wipe you out. Mm-hmm. End of discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. Key things with food and health. I mean, I'm glad that we live where we live, but last summer was this whole thing about avian flu. And I had a place for our chickens to go when they retire, so to speak. And it had 100,000 chickens, and they culled them and closed the farm to the public because they were worried about the virus, you know, instead of the COVID virus, it's the avian flu virus.
Right.
And
right.
So to me, I just don't like, if I have chickens, if they get sick, I try to help them. If they die, okay. But I'm not preemptively killing healthy chickens because of a fear of a virus.
Right.
And so some of that is fear.
So one of the other things I noted, I think is going to be a challenge in 2023, was a challenge in 2022, is disinformation. But disinformation that creates fear. Because, you know, in my experience, fear and money is a bad combination. and you know, it gets you to sell low and buy high. Mm-hmm. That's the only. So how do you, because I know when I was an investment advisor, I would have to talk people out of something. Disinformation would happen. It would cause panic and fear. And then I'd have to talk them down off the walls, you know, back into a state of, you know, sound decision making. How can you help people stay out of fear?
One thing I do, and I don't think it's unique, but is to talk about what is your fear, and then play out all the way to the end the worst possibility. And sometimes when you do that, you see like, okay, I wouldn't enjoy that, but it's not the end of the world. Or I tell there's other things sometimes, like I tell people, for scenarios, like I'm not planning to live through a nuclear holocaust. But one thing I did do was buy a Geiger counter, because then I can know if I'm being lied to. So if I see somebody on the TV that says we have a nuclear fallout, I can go outside and say, is this true where I live or not? So, but if there's a nuclear holocaust, I don't care. I'm going to be vaporized. So there's also some things not to plan for.
Right. It was so funny when I was in the United States in September and October, and I was flying back to Europe at the beginning of November. Mm-hmm. I was stunned, and everybody said, oh, well, you can't go back to Europe. You will freeze to death, and then you will die in a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you kidding me? And they'd say, Europe is falling apart. I said, really? Have you been downtown?
Yeah.
So, you know, right. Anyway, I'm convinced. I had one wonderful doctor tell me, he said, the top three killers during the pandemic were fear, fear, and fear.
I think that's a very wise statement.
Right. Okay, let's talk about opportunities, jurisdictions. So you moved to a great jurisdiction, right?
Yes.
How do you help people understand the importance of jurisdiction to their to their financial plan?
I think that they, some people, if they're in a bad jurisdiction, they're very aware of it. And if they're in a good jurisdiction, sometimes they're in a middle jurisdiction, not everything's black and white. I wouldn't say that I'm in a wonderful right. jurisdiction, but right. to me, what I'd say is get to know your neighbors. Go to local meetings. We've had battles here about different zoning issues and things. And through those battles, I got to know people.
Right.
So it's a double opportunity to say, hey, I'm going to understand more, because in every community, there's big money being injected to override the community, to do things the community doesn't want. And so no matter where you live, that exists. And
it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
There's things that certain things that happen that galvanize people. And all of a sudden, now I see that person in the grocery store. Hey, how are you? And you get to know people that way also.
Right. Okay. So hedged versus unhedged. I did a equity overview, I think about a year ago with Jason Wirth, where we went in detail through hedging. And one of the ways I've avoided bonds is just by keeping, you know, I don't want to worry about a big down. So I would much rather be in a hedged equity portfolio in many circumstances than a bond. It's not 100%, but it's a way of staying at something real. It's a way of staying at something that produces a dividend. I understand what it is. I like what it does. You know, I like companies, but I don't have to worry about a big down. So, and there's a lot of things that can happen in this world to bring about a big down. And I never, you know, I never underestimate the power of Mr. Global's ability to dump and pump.
Yeah.
So anyway, so talk a little bit about hedged versus unhedged.
Yeah, I think that episode with Jason Wirth is a great way to understand the hedge. And when I talk with people about that, we kind of come to the understanding that that's just an insurance policy. Because the only reason for anybody to have either a hedge or some other way to defend against losses is because they can't hold the stock. They don't want to hold the stock portfolio if it has huge ups and downs. And if you I tell people, if you wanted to just make the most money, you would hold an unhedged 100% stock portfolio because it would give you the highest return, but you have to be able to hold on to it. So hedging is one way. And then there's a cost. So a hedge is like an insurance policy. There's a cost to it. And so that's just a addition, you know, it subtracts a little from the return over time. And I think this episode with Jason Wirth showed that you can, if you're unhedged and the 60-40, like we already talked about, and you have long-term bonds, then that presents the fact that they're going to go down in value when interest rates go up. You can also you stay defensive. So you can have 1-year bonds or even cash, but then that brings up other issues. There's no perfect solution, because when you do that, the way you do it with hedging, you have the equity, you have the stock risk, the equity risk, but you don't have exposure to the credit risk for all the different things you're talking about, whether in the government or the missing money or all those things. If you're holding cash in a bank, you might say, oh, I like that because it's FDIC insured. Well, that brings up issues to the government. If I want to buy a 6-month T-bill, that might defend financially, but it's not addressing the credit issues. So there's no perfect solution. In that case, you may not have the same cost of the insurance of the hedge, but you're trading off one for the other.
So I always tell people I'm a squirrel. I have, you know, I have things all over and all these different things I think are pretty good, not perfect. And the idea is, you know, it's not an investment strategy. It's a war strategy. You know, I'm hoping that some of them make them through the war.
Yeah.
You know, but some are going to be taken out. But it's different scenarios where different things get taken out.
I thought one interesting thing, I watched that Financial Rebellion that you did about where to stash your cash. One very interesting idea is to put cash in a bank in a safe deposit box. So it's in the bank, but it's in the safe deposit box. You have different risk there. As long as you go into there and use the key, you can have your money. It's not subject to the implications when it's not. So.
Well, it was so funny because when I think I told the story in that one, you know, I helped several people clean up from Madoff, which was a very interesting, informative process of learning the, you know, the real deal on Madoff. It's a fascinating story. But one of the people who lost money on Madoff, and it was only a portion of what she had, said, you know, I'm tired of worrying about the financial system. And she literally got millions in cash out, put in her safe deposit box and said, I have enough cash to live on for the rest of my life. I'm just not gonna, I'm sick of worrying about all of this.
Or people, like people that live in rented apartments, or they live in the city, and they say, I don't want to have, I've listened to the safe thing, and but I don't want to have a safe. I'm only going to be here for a year. What can I do? And if I store money under there, then what if I have a fire?
Right.
So that's just a different solution that might be available.
Right. Anyway, so there's no perfect thing. Family wealth, I always try to encourage families to start a process of just conspiring together in wealth. You know, I love that Jay Hughes book called Family Wealth. But to me, getting great at building wealth, it's a process.
Yeah.
It's never over. It's like a journey. And part of it is creating an intention to do it together and to help each other. And one of the things I love that Hughes points out in Family Wealth is everybody in a family has gifts, and some gifts make money and some don't. But in fact, over a long period of time, if everybody just does their gift, it comes back around and makes a contribution. And I always laugh when I think about it, because I used to compete against Goldman Sachs a lot. And it was hard because they all had spouses who were active in the arts and culture, which would make them vicious competitors because they could always come around in the back door and get the board members through the arts and philanthropy. and so all that philanthropy ended up being very effective in when it came to getting business, and it made them tough competitors.
I think that one thing that he kind of alludes to in that book, because he's trying to talk about the positive, but to me, the biggest challenge in that whole thing that you outlined is the communication within families.
Right.
And anybody that lives in a family knows you,
right.
It's not happy life all the time. People argue, people have different personalities, and to try, if somebody can have the idea to try to bring people together, it's easier said than done. But I guess if you work at it and you kind of bring people along over time,
you have to do it. Not everybody in the family, you know, they're members of my family I don't speak to. You know, because there's such a thing as quality control. so it doesn't work with everybody. But I think if you have an intention of helping each other succeed, you know, I've found in the, you know, I'm just thinking of the Bushes. The Bushes really helped each other succeed. Not in a way I approve of, but they definitely conspired as a family.
I've said you're saying at my dinner table that your family are the people who won't turn you in. And my 16-year-old son looked at me and he's like, well, what if you murdered somebody? I'd have to turn you in then. So I was like, okay, that's a good point. So, but we had a discussion about it. So it's interesting.
I get a lot of questions about how to find professional help. Mm-hmm. And I just want to quickly walk through some of the key issues in someone finding professional help, because there seems to be not a clear position on how to use different financial professionals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first thing is you're in a jurisdiction and there are laws and rules and regulations related to financial professionals. And one way to find financial professionals is go to the associations or government regulators in your place. They keep lists and there's disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And on any good financial plan professional should have plenty of disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Now it takes time to research it, but between finding who's in your area, reading the disclosure and getting recommendations, there is a way to find people. And I don't know a financial professional who's not willing to have an introductory conversation to see if you're comfortable with them or not.
Absolutely.
Right. Right. So now, I think what's very hard for people in the Solari network is finding somebody who understands the real risk issues.
Yeah, and that can be hard, but there are people, there's got to be people out there. It's just you have to kind of find them. It's not, you know, the easiest thing, but I would say in that introductory meeting, say, here's some of the things I'm thinking about. What is your response to that? What would you say to that? Because that's important to me if I'm going to, and just make it part of your interview process. And you may discover that you've kind of come upon somebody that actually is willing to talk with you.
So one of the big confusions is the difference between a financial planner and an asset manager. I have asset managers constantly getting upset that somebody wants to come in and have them manage their money, but the next thing you know, they want 10 hours of free financial planning, and the asset manager's not set up to do that. That's not what they do. Okay, so you're a fee-only financial planner. Explain what that is and why that's different than an asset manager.
Yeah, so I'm a fee-only means that you know what you're paying. I tell you what I'm charging. And then you know what it is, and you can judge whether it's worth it to you or not. And that's a big incentive for somebody in my position to always be delivering value, to make sure that you want to keep paying the fee, you know?
Right.
There are people that work, traditionally stockbrokers worked on commission, that kind of advisor is still out there. And so understanding the way people get paid can impact the type of advice you get. Because if somebody's working on commission, then they are maybe calling you with stock ideas, because the only way they get paid is if you buy a stock. And then there are people in the middle. And a lot of the terms out there have been created to confuse. There's a term called fee-based, which really means fee and commission. And all of this is fine. It's not wrong. But to me, I'd suggest the biggest thing you want to understand is how, in addition to the due diligence about people, how does your professional get paid? And understand that and know what you're paying. There's an old saying in poker, if you don't know who the patsy is, you're the patsy. So,
right.
And you can find this out, and just ask people explicitly, and then do the trust but verify. Say, okay, here's what he said. Here's what she said. Now let's check against what the documents say. And if that matches and you're comfortable, then that's a good way to go. But an asset manager isn't prepared, like you said. So these type of questions that we're talking about, an asset manager, even if they could answer them, they don't have time to do that. They're working on focusing on asset management. So if you know, I'm good. I have a CPA, I have an attorney, and I just want somebody to maximize returns, then maybe an asset manager is good for you. But if you come into things with all these other questions, you either have to build your own team of those people, CPA, lawyer, asset manager, or a financial planner like me can integrate a lot of it.
Right. So that's the idea. You've got all this different stuff and different pieces. You're the guy who integrates everything. Yeah. Right. So one of the reasons I stopped being an investment advisor is the regulators wanted me to give them all the private data that my clients had shared with me about their non-securities, non-bank holdings. Mm-hmm. And that I just said, I'm not doing that. And they wanted me to load cybersecurity software that was going to give, you know. And I told my clients, stop sharing that with financial, you know, you don't need to share everything with financial professionals.
Yeah.
How does somebody deal with all these different financial professionals and still maintain some kind of privacy?
Well, you at the extreme, you could just say, I'm going to deal in paper and I'm going to redact every account number. At some point, if you're working cooperatively with people, it becomes somewhat of an impediment to efficient communication, but you might give that up and say, this is super important to me.
So I'm not worried about any accounts because accounts are fully disclosed in the system. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about, you know, I've got $100,000 of gold sitting in the safe at home. I don't want that going to the state regulators, that information.
Yeah. I mean, I've been audited by our state, and to me, not that they can't ask for it, but I don't know that I would disclose that on that unless they specifically asked what other advice. Usually they're very head down, like, you know, here's your assets that you said on your regulatory form. Show me how the evidence for that. Here, you say that you meet with people. Show me the number of times you met with them. Right. And so it's in my experience anyway on an audit, I've not been asked to disclose all these other assets, especially if they're like precious metals or things that are not in the investment account.
Right, right. So I'm assuming there's a way working with different people that you can keep some kind of privacy. So,
yeah, you just have to manage it. I mean, I use there are secure websites that you can use. Now that nothing's perfectly secure, right? Then you can, well, is it secure?
Right.
But you can give different permissions to different people in a more efficient way that way that's encrypted. There's some technology solutions which introduces another aspect, but I think the main thing is to just know what you're giving to people and who you're giving it to. I think that most people, when they're under audit, it doesn't mean they can't ask for it, but I try when I represent people to the IRS. When I call the IRS, my goal is to get as much information from them and give them as little or nothing as possible.
So, now, are you doing tax preparation or you just work? You do. So, okay. Well, that's a big advantage. And,
yeah. And to me that I do it that way because I used to work at the JP Morgan Private Bank and I was told to tell people on the phone, I'm sorry. You have to talk to your tax advisor. So right. I was like, why can't we tell them? So that's why I started down this road to operate the way I do.
Well, it's very, very helpful. Now, do you do out-of-state people on taxes or just in-state?
Most states, you have to, there's different registrations and things in different states, but yes.
Now, what about insurance? Will you work with people's insurance broker on insurance questions?
Yeah, so the big thing about fee only is I do not sell financial products at all. Nothing to sell.
Right.
So in that case, it'd say, well, let's go shopping. And now you have an informed shopper with you. And we'll say either if they already have it, I'll review it and say, why don't we ask some questions? Let's have a conversation here and ask some questions about this and tell them ahead of time. And then I'll go with them to the meeting if they want and ask the questions, but I'll work cooperatively with those people to get a good deal, to get effective insurance, not to get insurance that you don't need, to get good insurance. And then to make sure you're not overpaying and you're not doing things. So
I find that most people do two things. They underpay on fees because they don't pay for the help and education that they need. So it's funny, last year my account was retiring. Mm-hmm. So I paid the new accountant to do the taxes and I paid the old accountant to do the taxes. I doubled up my CPA mm-hmm. fees. It turned out the new accountant had to leave faster than expected. So thank God, the old had to leave faster than expected. So the new was finally filed it, but we made sure that the information got transferred. Now I doubled up on fees, but to me it was a great
investment. But you're unique. You're absolutely right. In my business, fees, when people know what they're paying, they don't want to pay. When the fee is, it's called saliency. When there's saliency, when you see it, you don't want to pay. When it's in the background, you'll let it go and pay a higher fee.
So I told you this story that my first day at Goldman Sachs as a summer intern on Wall Street, the Goldman partner was smoking his cigar, was sitting in his office. I spent the day following him around, seeing what it was all about. At the end of the day, he hung up with his cigar and he said, "Trust me, honey, getting a good CPA and a good attorney and you'll make it. Without it, you'll never make it." So it got built in. Okay, so I just want to show you. So this isn't ready. This will be ready in a month. And I can't wait to show it to you when it's ready. But we decided to take all of our information about how to integrate your life with your finances. This is a curriculum and it's in six parts. I don't know if you've seen the Stripe system at Episcopal Academy in Philadelphia, but I poached it from them. They have 10 stripes, we have six. But the first part starts with your free and inspired life. And my feeling is, and I really learned this from doing investment advisory, everybody's different. Everybody's different and their age, their circumstance, their family needs, their risk tolerance, but they have a purpose in life. And, some people should not have their money in a brokerage account. They should have it building their business. So you really have to start with you and what your purpose is. Okay. So your free and inspired life navigation tools is a lot about what we do at the Solaria Report, which is helping people get a good map. And I always say, the official reality is for cocktail parties and reality is for your investments and risk strategy. And you don't want to get those mixed up. So a lot of it's about sort of helping you understand the real deal and what it means to you. Then risk management. To me in this environment, risk management is so much more important than investment strategy. Because one vaccine injury can wipe out your entire net worth. Living equity is all about building good relationships, family, community, colleagues, everything else, and the living equity part. And it's what's really funny, Tim, is My experience is the world is full of people who love living equity and hate financial equity, or people who love financial equity and hate living equity. And success, financial success, to me comes from integrating the two and having them give energy to each other. It's one of the reasons I love you, because you understand this totally.
To me, it's the only way it works. But one suggestion for this, if somebody wants to try to take this whole thing and create it for themselves, something to look at is what are called mind maps, where you can you could put all on one page all of this for your life. And I think that's one thing you could look at is how do people put do a mind map, basically get their whole financial and living equity and everything on one sheet of paper, because then you can at least have an understanding of how everything works together.
So I'll give you an example. Each one of these goes down to a summary of what this area is about. And then it's a way of organizing all of our content. Now we just have it one page, but it's all, you know, the different areas, for example, of risk management and different resources we have on those different aspects.
That looks terrific.
And I can't wait to show it to you when it's done. I hope to have it done by the end of February, and then we'll publish it in hard copy. But anyway, it's our effort to kind of show what we are sort of, it's one way for a beginner to come into Salera Report, access the content, but access the content around a process of achieving in your life what you want to achieve. And I think, you know, when you look at a good financial plan, it's really just about helping you get clear about, you know, what do you want to accomplish in your life and how are you going to do it?
Yeah.
Really.
And then to some degree, holding you accountable in some way along the way.
Right. Anyway, so more on this when we have it. But I get back to what I said about building process, which is achieving this kind of result of really building wealth, whether it's living equity or financial equity, hopefully both, it really is a matter of creating an intention and just working at it. It's a journey. And, you know, every week, you know, I'll never forget one of the guys I worked with who was in the public relations field when I was on Wall Street. He said, I have budgeted 3 hours a night, one night a week. I told my wife, I'm just working on building our wealth. So he just budgeted the time and he just went at it, and he committed. All his life he'd not been interested in money, but he committed, I'm going to learn about money and I'm going to get myself educated, I'm going to get on top of this. And over many, many years he got really,
but
really
at some
good.
Point he just got started, but right? There was one day he just got started,
right? Yeah. It's almost like a habit. Learning about building wealth is just a habit.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So in closing, I am going to put a link to that Financial Rebellion on, you know, I think it was
31.
Well, no, it was 30 ways of
Something
31
like
ways of stashing.
Your
it was episode 31, but I think there were about 20 or 30 ways of stashing your cash. Before we close, anything else you want to add or tell us also how to find you?
Yeah, I think, Looking ahead here, it looks like we may have another interesting year ahead of us. And, you know, I look forward to navigating it with the Solari network. And you could find me at copperbeachadvisors.com. My email is tim.caban@copperbeachadvisors.com. And my phone number is 610-647-4014.
So I'm going to be in, I'm flying to the United States for April. I'm coming into Philadelphia, but then I'll take down to Tennessee and I'll be back in Pennsylvania, in Malvern for the last 2 weeks. So I'm going to invite you out.
I would love to join you. That would be a privilege and an honor.
It would be fun. Okay, Tab. Thank you for joining us on the Salera Report, ladies and gentlemen. Check out the website. There's a wealth of information and other things, and I'll put the links that Tim and I discussed today up. And thank you for joining us on the Equity Overview.
Thanks, Catherine.
Have a great day.